Mr. Crawford. Question?
Mel, I don't know your background. So when you say you're in the city,
I stumbled across the here this morning. I am owner and director of Riffermill Landscape Architects. We are a Christchurch based practice. Peter Ruff, who you may be familiar with perhaps over the years, a landscape architect, Peter and I merged our two companies back in 2010. Peter now is in senior retirement. So we have a practice in Christchurch. We have 14 landscape architects and urban design in that practice. We operate an office in Wanaka as well, and we have 3 landscape architects in our Wanaka office. And I have been practicing as a landscape architect since 1996. And at the moment, my workload consists of pretty much South Island, we do North Island work, but also Queensland Lakes District. In terms of the South Island work, Queensland Lakes District, Canterbury, and the top of the South Island.
And are you another one who's come out of Lincoln?
I am indeed. Uh-huh. A graduate of Lincoln, and as well as running the practice, I lecture and tutor back out of Lincoln University from time to time. I'm currently doing that at the moment.
And with respect to the preparation, Nikki Smedlin's evidence is basically your evidence.
So Nikki Nikki and I prepared it together. At the time, we were stretched over 2 or 3 different projects, and so she had put her name to that. I was available to come to the hearing, so that's
And so have you done the site visits and been down the river on the raft and done all that stuff?
So I can clarify, I haven't been on the river.
You haven't?
I haven't been on the river. I have been on site at least 3 times. I was currently involved in a project just along from the site, which I have been on that site at least 3 or 4 times as well. So I'm very familiar with the site. I was with Nikki when the photos were taken of her original graphic attachment. And then, as I mentioned at the very start of my summary, Jeremy London from our office, who was another landscape architect, not to cloud things or such, but he specialises in the visuals. So he has been on site, and he has taken photographs for those visual simulations as well. And maybe if I, just because I'll touch on that now, he took photographs, and then his surveyor from Patterson Pitts came and surveyed the points to make sure that they are accurate to the site. So there's quite a process behind those simulations there as well. In terms of Karara River, I have walked to the corners of the AA2 zone that we've shown on the amended structure plan that is posted on the wall. And from there, I couldn't see the river myself, but I had not been on the river. So I just want to make that clear. The structure plan that was submitted along with Evidence in Chief showed the AA2 zone going further out. And I understand from reading the rebuttal evidence of Dr. Reed and Mr. Buxton that they were responding to that. And then we have since, prior to reading the rebuttal and submitting further evidence, pulled out structures on that. Hence, I will understand one of the reasons why Dr. Ruth has needed or changed her position.
Okay.
Does that clarify?
Yes. No, that's good. And I had one observation, really, more than anything, in your summary of paragraph 10. You helpfully just say what it means to absorb change. I've been listening to landscape architects for weeks, and they always wave their hands and say that landscape can absorb the change. And I think finally I've seen someone define it.
I'm glad.
It means avoiding skylines, bridges, hills, and prominent slopes.
It does indeed. And also, there are a number of things.
In this case,
there are a number of things in the landscape that help absorb change as well. So, landforms are one of them. And obviously, a backdrop of landforms absorbs change. When we think of landform, we think of land cover as well.
how that helps absorb change within the landscape. I also think about patterns in the landscape. And patterns of existing dwellings or existing settlement help absorb proposed change as well.
Yeah, and in this particular case, the viewing is from the highway?
Yes, it is from the highway.
In the main, because I mean, you can, we can have the Crown Range,
might say.
You can look down on the parts, but from the Crown Range,
yes.
In general.
And I have stopped and viewed it from the top of the Crown Range as well. And yes, you see it. One of the things we must remember when you view from above is that you see a lot of other things in the context of what you're looking at. But yes, primarily from the ground, let's say, is in public view, but it's from, say, Highway 6. And that's reflected in the objectives and policies of the Gibson Charity Zone as well.
No, I have no issue with that. I was just going to lead to my next question, really, which was with the visual images showing the schist wall and the planting of whatever it is.
Yes. Yes, it's a here.
Well, you're in a car, will you be able to see past that?
That
to the ONL that we're all trying to put you back to protect.
It's really, really good question. The ONL goes all the way to all the way to the summit, so obviously on your own. So you'll be able to see tops and upper slopes, but you'll be right, certainly. You'll be able to see long views, and often when we are travelling on the road, it's those long views that are front of vision that we're focusing on. If one was to turn so that the right hand is as one's driving, yes, you'll be presented with the hedge, you'll be presented with the vine, you'll be presented with perhaps the porch and tree.
Just on that point, why was the camera height of 1.5 metres chosen?
Sorry, what's that?
Why was the camera height of 1.5 metres chosen?
It was chosen because that is the, I suppose, the standard height if you're standing. Bearing in mind that if you're travelling in a car, your eyesight is on your eye level. Depending on the car as well, is typically around about 1.2 of height. But we chose 1.5 because that was, we were able to get somebody on the site to take photos of their height. That's the most accurate way to do that.
I may be biased, but I think
1.8. Well, indeed, that's right. We can all extend that. But no, look, you know, that it's sort of, I suppose, that the best practice.
The other question I had was in Smeaton's evidence, in paragraph 8, he said that the proposed subzone was for the most part within the Gibson character zone. I just wondered which parts came from the Gibson character zone.
I'll clarify that. That subzone has all been amended such that it isn't all within the Gibson character zone.
Right.
There's no intent to have any rural general zone rezoned in the Gibson character zone. Everything's out of the subzone.
Yeah. The evidence is heavily reliant on the productive planting area.
Yes,
isn't it? And we've already discussed about whether the additional planting should be put in before. What would happen if things changed in the wine industry in 10, 15, 20 years' time and they became uneconomic or inappropriate and these plantings were all pulled out?
Yeah, let's look at that's a very good question. I'll answer it in two fronts, I suppose. The activity areas predominantly are also set back from the state island. So distance and viewer distance is one thing to be considered. Yes, there are productive landscape areas in front, but viewing distance from the road. And that was alluded to in the O8 decision as well. I think if you're familiar with that, distance was given as a reason of acceptability and the landscape to absorb as well. In terms of productive planting, there was going to be a mix of vines as well as fruit trees and orchard trees. and nut trees. Now, one would assume, and one can only guess, that yes, if the grape industry at the bottom fell out in 20 years, those vines were replaced, fruit trees or other planting, perhaps would be planting within those areas. So it's a combination of planting and viewing business. Where the activity areas touch the road, or meet the road, it's slightly closer, it is in the Vintners Village. So, part of the subzone and the provisions for that, as shown in those simulations as well, is the stone wall and the hedge planting proposed by Gibson Valley Station along the front of the road boundary in places. And one would imagine that, irrespective of what happened to grapes in time, that stone on the hedge would remain. And that also has bearing on visibility.
Are you concerned that, just dealing with the stone walls, I'm looking at from question one, for example, with the wall and then the planting plant as viewed from the road.
Yes.
Is this going to create a sort of a channelised impression for travellers on the road?
Yeah. I think potentially that could happen. But as you look at, say, if we're looking at artist impression one as well, we've got that wall and the hedge in the immediate sort of foreground, the side ground, if that's a term. There is still sort of ample view of the landform beyond and a landform ahead. So I don't believe it will. And also, that will be confined to areas, and it's not all the way along the subset. And it's an interesting part of the landscape there is that it's quite narrow through sections of the subzone compared to other parts of the Gibson Valley as well. So the landscape comes and goes as one travels through the character zone. It's not homogeneous throughout its entirety.
Can you help me with that? The subzone will allow development of tourism hubs on the culinary and enology school and get a children conference and seat.
I'm not sure where you seat it, I should have been there. Sorry.
I couldn't even figure out what the other word was.
I as frequently would be associated buildings.
Okay.
I read through that last night and I wouldn't.
Can I go back to the Crown Range?
Yes.
Because the evidence at paragraph 94 is indistinguishable from the Crown Range, right?
Yeah.
You talk about the top of the Crown Range, right? But more importantly is the lookout somewhere down on the Queenstown side, somewhere distance down from the top. Actually, when we stood there and looked at it, it seemed Gibson was there beneath our feet, and it was noticeable.
I agree, and perhaps I can clarify that that paragraph. One needs to bear in mind that when you're looking down from there, you would perhaps, or you need to be considering the consented development as well.
Yes.
And so if that consented development is realised, we're then considering what further development the subzone allows over and above that consented development. And hence the term indistinguishable is relating to that difference between what is consented yet unrealised on the site and what this hub zone enables.
So from that viewpoint, sort of what would be the principal additional proposals that we might see?
For sure. So what you will see, I'll hit you with this really for start, and it probably won't mean a lot. What you'll see is over and above what is consented will be another 1.9 hectares of building across the zone. That works out to be approximately 1.5% further site coverage of that zone over and above what's been consented.
Okay, that's the average.
So
in terms of any particular parts of the site,
Sure.
How much of that is clustered, for example?
So, and can I talk
to you?
So the main difference you'll see is AA2. Because this consented development doesn't allow, or doesn't, it shows part of the golf course coming across activity here at AA2. So you'll see built element here, built form here. The consented development allows for 30 accommodation units, as well as a community building association with the golf course in the area of AA5. Subzone is enabling further 20.
Just going back to AA2.
Yes.
That's 1.3 hectares. Of the additional development, isn't it, AA2?
Yes.
So the bulk of it is actually...
Is an AA2, and perhaps that's a good way to finish, is that what is enabled, what is provided in the underlying... the existing consent for AA3 and AA4, the majority of that is within AA3. Some of that, which was in the existing consent, is actually in AA6, which we've now called AA6. So some of that consented development, there were 42, if you remember from there, it was the there were 42 buildings, plus another 13 ancillary buildings, plus another 6 down by Tom's Creek. Well, that's spread over AA3 and AA6, with another 6 in AA6, and AA8 is new built form.
what you can see from the Crown Range,
yes,
is particularly AA2.
AA2, but from the Crown Range, the valley unfolds, and you'll see, you see parts, you see more, but that will be the noticeable change. And that change is centred around the existing Gibson Valley Winery buildings and what's known as AA1. So that will certainly read as a cluster.
Surprisingly similar to the paragraphs 1, 2, 3 that we took as read on Friday morning. So if I could skip through those and just kick in that paragraph 4 for some respect.
Yes.
So in my evidence in chief, I set out that at present Gibson Valley Highway, Step Highway 6, has traffic patterns that are commensurate with a highway which carries both commuter type traffic as well as serving recreational and tourist type activities. Highest traffic flow in any peak hour is 510 vehicles, it's two-way, and allowing for the prevailing 4.1% per annum ambient traffic growth, the highway will provide level service D in 10 years' time. For the past 5 years, there have been nine crashes on the highway. The crash rate of the majority of the highways is commensurate with the national average of highways of this nature, but there have been 3 injury crashes at the entrance to the winery, one in 2004, one in 2005, and one in 2006, which is higher than I'd expect, with the NZTA crash prediction equation suggesting that just one crash could be expected over 5 years. I anticipate that improved signage would assist in addressing this, potentially with some minor geometric improvements, since it appears that a contributing factor has been that drivers have failed to notice the access. In the event that the submitted proposals are accepted, I expect that this will occur. At present, there's a variety of developments in the Gibson Valley Winery, which is already consented but not presently constructed. I discussed this in my evidence in chief, but the important aspect to note is that the receiving environment is not what is presently seen on site, but rather it's a more developed environment and thus higher prevailing traffic generation. In my evidence in chief, I assessed a scenario provided to me which allowed for a nominal number of residential units, visitor accommodation units, staff accommodation, and other activities, including the already consented business market. Since that time, I understand that the development scenario has been confirmed within the district plan provision sought as a result of clarifying issues raised by the council. In particular, the provisions now provide for a maximum of 120 residential units, 150 visitor accommodation units, and 90 worker accommodation units as permitted activities. At greater levels of development, the activity status is at least restricted discretionary, and requires an assessment of the traffic effects at that time. Taking account of the confirmed amount of permitted development, I've recalculated the traffic generation and my assessment shows that the amount of traffic generated is 20% lower than in my earlier analyses in the morning peak hour, and 13% lower in the evening peak hour. That's 49 vehicle movements two-way in each peak hour. Although this will have a consequential and beneficial effects on the queue lengths and delays that I previously identified, in practice these changes will be small. This is because the reduction in traffic is in the order of one vehicle movement every 1.2 minutes. In my experience, changes of this magnitude do not significantly alter the performance of intersections unless the intersection is heavily congested, which is not the case here. Importantly, in this location, State Highway 6 is a limited access road, which means that any vehicle crossing has to be licensed by the New Zealand Transport Agency in respect of both the location of the crossing and also the volume of traffic permitted to use them. This provides an assurance under wholly different legislation to the Resource Management Act that if the agency considers that adverse traffic effects will arise from any development within the site, they are able to refuse a licence to the proposed crossing point. Just responding to Mr. Mander's rebuttal evidence, Mr. Mander highlights, if that's my assessment, is based on only one of a number of development scenarios. I agree, but as noted above, my scenario includes a greater amount of traffic than can occur as a permitted activity under the proposed rule package. I therefore consider it robust. With regard to the access points to the site, Mr. Mander highlights that the stretch plan shows only one, whereas I referred to four within my evidence in chief. Having reviewed the structure plan, I confirm that four points of access onto the highway are shown, and I understand that these are approved by NZTA. Finally, Mr. Mander highlights concerns that the development could make use of Resta Road, it's a local road, as a way of avoiding triggering the requirements of the limited access road provisions. He notes that his concerns will be allayed if any consent application affecting the site was required to be notified to NZTA. As I noted above, any change to the location or volume of traffic using State Highway 6 will require NZTA to be notified due to the limited access road status. But the zone provisions also set out that NZTA is to be notified if amendments are made to any access points shown on the structure plan. Given that NZTA has not submitted an obligation to violate station submission, I anticipate that these provisions are acceptable to the Transport Agency. And accordingly, I remain able to support the rezoning of the site.
I have a question for, may not be best with this to you, but anybody at the table. This issue of notifying, a rule which requires that NZTA be notified has come up previously, particularly in relation to Jack's point, but I think one or two other instances. And my question is really, is that legally able to be done within the parameters of the RMA? Probably not a question for you, Andrew.
I can give it a go, but to give it to my better place or this department.
Yeah, I think from a planning perspective, I can understand the question, certainly. The subdivision chapter of the proposed plan, I understand also the offer plan includes the provision as well, relating that, so it's come through from the offer into the proposed. It's for accesses of state highways that have a speed limit of greater than 70 kilometres, I believe the wording is. It's in the chapter 27 provisions. Whether or not that's a lawful approach, I'm not sure. That might defer that one down the chain, Mr. Parker, but it has always been in there. It may be the first part of the statute that Mr. Carr was referring to before.
I think it can be done. It wouldn't, in my view, it shouldn't specify NZTA per se, but it might refer to a body that controls that highway in a more general way. Thus, it would cover situations of successor bodies, that sort of thing. But such specificity doesn't sit well with what is essentially part of the statute. Subordinate legislation doesn't normally give down to such specificity.
As I say, it's been raised, the legality of provisions like that has been raised by practically all lawyers in the Jack's Point case.
Yeah.
And if it's in the plan, and it comes to a consent, I'm sure the council will honour it.
Yes.
I can't imagine who would challenge them for doing so.
Yeah, I agree. I think it is a difficult legal issue in itself. but the pragmatic approach seems to mean that it gets on with it in the way that you suggested.
I was just saying, I think there's a similar provision in the New Christchurch plan about notification of under certain circumstances to particular parties, and I don't think that was one part that was a big one.
You don't think?
I don't think that was a particular provision that was subject to subsequent appeal.
I just want to check something if you can.
Sure.
The risk of the zone and the future potential development of that is factored into the traffic model? Or do we need to kind of go in our heads and think, what else might be on the road in 10 years' time?
What's included within the modelling is everything that's permitted or controlled. And subject to those limits that are in the provisions. And anything beyond that becomes restricted discretionary or more significant assessment is required. And in each and every case, access and parking are matters of discretion of which the council can reserve its concerns. So in that particular issue, there's two bites of the cherry, if you like. The first thing is that the council gets the opportunity to have a look at it under limited restricted discretionary activity, but also NZTA gets an opportunity under the limited access road legislation, because it will increase the amount of traffic on a particular access, and that gives NZTA the ability to look at it as well. So what's modelled is permitted and controlled, plus what's consented. And Mr. Gibbs and I had a discussion about whether there's a double dipping in there. We can confirm that there isn't. So, for example, where we've got within AA1, for example, consent is only 50 visitor accommodation units, and under the zoning provisions, there's 50 visitor accommodation units. In total, that would mean that there's 50 visitor accommodation units. The proposed 50 is not in addition to the consented 50.
Yeah, I was going from another angle, because most of the activities in the existing zone are discretionary. So when you're talking about your model, it doesn't anticipate those, it only incorporates them when a consent is granted.
Correct.
Yeah. Thank you. That's good. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Just on paragraph 5 of your summary, and you've also got in your main brief of evidence, you say, talking about the crashes and improved signage, etc. Does it need the zone change for that signage to occur?
No, it doesn't. The signage can take place as it's right within the road corridor.
Now, the other thing is, just talking about the modelling, have you excluded the golf course? I just want to understand that.
The golf course was excluded from the initial modelling within my evidence to chief for the revisiting of the assessment, which I've described in my summary statement. I included it, but it's included as part of the baseline plus part of the proposed outcomes. And so, if you like, it appears on both the top and the bottom of the fraction to cancel each other out. In absolute terms, a golf course doesn't generate that much traffic because you've got a certain limitation on the number of people that can play, and all of the traffic analysis is done on the peak hours. So it only sort of works out of sort of 14 or 15 vehicles in the whole of the peak hour. And so that it's not that sensitive to that amount of traffic.
Now, just in paragraph 61, you're talking about the need for some upgrading of the rest of the road, and you said that that's provided for under the existing consented development. How can a zoning provision ensure that that same upgrading occurred?
Well, the zone provision I think that there's a couple of issues in there, one of which is the existing consents in that particular area. And as I was talking to Mr. Hunt before, Gibson Valley has been talking with NZTA about how Preston Road will be used, because this issue about Preston Road came up previously. And Gibson Valley is undertaking that Preston Road, most of which is actually private, would be closed in the future with a link through the site. To reduce the amount of traffic on Preston Road. Obviously, if there was subdivision, then the council is able to impose a condition of consent in that regard. But I think that the risk of kicking the can down the road, that's the sort of thing that would normally come through with subsequent consents for the visitor, for the worker accommodation in that particular area.
Given that the workers' accommodation is probably the biggest primary development potential off Preston Road initially, there's nothing in that which would give the power, council any power to require an upgrade. And presumably, workers' accommodation wouldn't be subdivided.
Potentially. Certainly goes to that issue you talked about this morning about limiting worker accommodation or not limiting worker accommodation to people working in Gibson Valley. If it's 90 units or people working within close proximity to Gibson Valley, it's a different traffic generation, it's a different level of improvement that would be required to rest of road.
I'm not concerned about whether there's a requirement.
Yeah.
I'm concerned about how, if there is, the council could achieve such a requirement.
The exercise of control is limited to access as vehicle parking.
Yes, I wonder whether the access of vehicle parking maybe isn't sufficiently specific for that particular.
Yeah, I think that's the case. The way to address that, and again, Ms. Hunt might have viewed this being involved in the original decision, is that access actually from that A88 could still be through the rest of the Valley site. So rather than coming off the rest of the road itself, you still have to go through Gibson Valley Station to get through to A88. So you're not actually accessing onto the state highway. That could be an option. I could have to amend the provisions to provide for that.
But if it was to be... No, I want this to give us to answer for the moment, and then you can have a go. if it was to be taken directly to Rester Road, is that 23.412 provision sufficient then for the council to widen its inquiry and directly look at the intersection? Road, or would that deal with the intersection?
Yeah, well, I was just thinking actually into the district plan definition of access, that could actually be the allotment to the road boundaries rather than the road itself. So, yeah. So that would be a straightforward insertion to just specifically specify roading.
Roading access.
Roading access.
I'd just Also, Mr. Gibbons, we're looking at your Appendix 3, where you have amendments to Chapter 27. Maybe I should have asked you about this earlier, but are you aware that Mr. Bryce's recommended version of Chapter 27 says that all subdivision, where there's a structure plan involved, that it complies with it is controlled?
Rather than discretionary?
Yes.
When I did the Section 32 analysis, or waiting, first answer is no. When I did the Section 32 analysis, was on the proposed plan as notified because there was no certainty that the panel would accept any recommendations on matters moving forward. If it was controlled, those matters are not listed as matters of discretion. Could well be imposed as matters of control. I guess, thinking out loud, the only real matter that you'd want to have some certainty on for being a restricted discretion activity for affected parties would be the ZTA in terms of this access matter onto the highway, given that we are specifying for specific access points. But if that was the order which Mr. Manford mentioned before, that seems to be covered, and that is restricted discretionary activity, irrespective of the subdivision being controlled or not.
Well, the question that again? Well, I think the simple question is Gibson Valley Station requesting that it be, in this instance, restricted discretionary?
Yes, well, that's what the request is.
Right.
Well, I'm confused. What was the outcome of that?
So I was talking about the NZTA that you referred to earlier on, that requiring automatic affected persons approval that's contained within Chapter 27 of the district plan. So given that Gibson Valley Station is on a state highway, irrespective of if Mr. Bryce's recommendation was accepted by the panel that all subdivision is controlled activity, then inadvertently the restricted discretionary status of would still be triggered because Gibson Valley Station is on a state highway. Hopefully that's a bit clearer.
Well, in an answer to my question, you said that in fact Gibson Valley Station was happy for it to be restricted discretionary in any event. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct, and that's how that's what it proposed.
Yep. So what, in terms of your passage here, what do we have to change to bring that about, if anything?
Sorry, sir?
So what, is there anything to bring about that IDA status? What has, if anything, has to be changed in these rules?
No change.
No change? Well, just in terms of your matters of discretion listed in item 3, relating to Chapter 27 in Appendix 3, when the road upgrading of existing roads become a matter of discretion?
The closest to that is access. So the 27.7.22.1 is a matter of discretion.
Simply access.
So that could be clarified as Mr. Cart's comment to road access. So it's clear that it's not just access to a legal boundary, by rest of road, it could be any legal road.
In which floor?
That's Appendix 3 of my evidence in chief. Matter point 3, and the clause is 27.7.22.1. It's the matters of discretion.
There, I find that. Appendix 3 of your...
Yes, the evidence in chief, it was the heading for it is Chapter 27, subdivision developments, the amended rules for the Gibson Valley subzone, which I'm proposing to be inserted into the district plan.
So 27 point what?
It's on the front page.
Yeah, 27 point. Oh, that one.
And it's point 3 on in that document on the first page.
The subdivision design has begun to minimise the number of acres. What?
Would it help if I showed you the document?
The same? Yeah. Discretion. And that currency is access and it's limited to road access. Okay. So that's in case of subdivision. So what about an application which isn't a subdivision?
Just in response to Mr. Carr's query for comment before, it was under Rule 23.4.12. Where currently it says access and vehicle parking.
Yes.
It's adding another matter of control there for roading access.
Roading access?
Correct.
Thank you. I'll start with item 4, water supply. That's fine. Two sources of water have been confirmed. These are from Tom's Creek, which is a large upland catchment on the south side of State Highway 6, and from the Kawarau River. There is a preliminary design for both supplies, and Gibson Valley Station holds consents for water takes for both water sources. It is likely that both water sources will be used for development of Gibson Valley Station. Wastewater treatment and dispersal. Gibson Valley Wines Limited currently operates a wastewater treatment facility with the existing winery under consents issued by the Otago Regional Council in 2014. Gibson Valley Station did hold a consent to discharge treated wastewater issued by the Otago Regional Council in 2008 for the Gibson Valley Station project, but this has since lapsed, and a renewal application is being prepared for the same dispersal site under the same flowway. water supply and wastewater infrastructure. From my review of the development activities that are provided for throughout the proposal and taking into account the areas of land available for wastewater management and sources for water supply, I consider that disposal of wastewater and supply of water can be satisfactorily managed on-site while avoiding adverse off-site effects. There are ample opportunities for direct stormwater. There are ample opportunities to direct stormwater from the proposed development to existing watercourses and streams that flow through culverts under State Highway 6. Some consents from the Tauga Regional Council are already held for larger flows by Gibson Valley Wines Limited and Gibson Valley Station. Power supply and telecommunications. Both utility companies provided letters to Gibson Valley Station for the previous development proposal, confirming that they could provide power and telecommunications supply in 2008. Updated letters will be sought for any zone and development changes as part of the land use consenting. Natural hazards. Tonkin and Taylor geotechnical engineers prepared a natural hazard assessment and preliminary geotechnical investigation for the Gibson Valley Station proposal in March 2008. A copy of this investigation report comprises Appendix 7 to Mr. Gibbons' evidence in chief. The potential risk to property was assessed as nil, very low, low to moderate, and moderate, the last being for earthquake ground shaking. For 10 listed hazards, including liquefaction, which was low to nil. Refer to page 17 of the 10T report. There are 6 pages of conclusions and recommendations in this very comprehensive report, pages 32 to 37. The follow-up letter from Tonkin and Taylor, dated 4th of April 2008, added detail to 3 specific areas. I have 2 copies here, which I can pass on.
Yes, thank you.
Do you want to have... It's a bit long. I didn't make 15 copies of it.
It's a short video.
In the follow-up letter, it refers specifically in item 4 in that follow-up letter to the upper part of activity area 8 adjacent to Rister Road. It's the only area of the current development proposal that is outside the original Tonkin and Taylor report study area. This will need further geotechnical investigation, which will be done at the resource consent application stage when there is more design detail. The evidence of Ulrich Lesner for Queensland Lakes District Council. I'm referring to his evidence. I confirm that the development proposal will be serviced privately at the developer's cost and that there will be no increase to the QMDC infrastructure requirements.
Mr. Kino, you'll recall we had a discussion last Thursday about zoning and on-site wastewater disposal and effects on waterways covered by water conservation orders and nutrient effects on them. It doesn't seem to be covered in your evidence, but I'm just wondering whether, in fact, the disposal can be achieved in such a way that the natural character of the Karawa River can continue with minimal effect on nutrient levels.
The difference with that and this situation is that Gibson Valley Station holds and did hold a consent and still holds another consent that's actually in operation since 2015 for the disposal of wastewater to ground adjacent to the, or between the highway and the river. Those consents, when they were issued, took account of the legislation at the time by the Tauga Regional Council. I'm not sure if you what you're referring to in terms of the Water Conservation Act, it was certainly considered at that time and will be in the renewal of the consent that has lapsed.
But there's a whole lot more development being proposed.
Yes.
I mean, we're talking just roughly off the top of my head, a couple of hundred households equivalent.
Yes. Obviously, it needs more dispersal area because it's a factor of area. There is a considerable amount of area available. In fact, we've known in 2008 when the Gibson Valley Station project was proposed, a lot of the land on the riverside of State Highway 6 was allocated to golf course, and the decision at that time was not to try to use that land for also for disposal of wastewater. And so the golf course area has allowed additional land to be available for wastewater disposal, quite considerable amount. A lot of that has been tested. There was a report by Gibson, I can't remember the name of the company now, there was a report prepared after quite a lot of test pitting, soil analysis and infiltration rate analysis. Well beyond just the area that was chosen and consented in 2008.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
On the stormwater, Mr. Boomer, in paragraph 19 of your evidence in chief, I inferred from reading that you'd assessed stormwater disposal from the south side of the State Highway, but not the north. Whereas in your current statement, I mean it's clear. So, can you tell me? So, paragraph 19 says it will all be collected and piped to existing watercourses that pass through culverts under State Highway 6, Dardy Dun. I inferred that to mean that you looked at the south side, but not the north side of the State Highway.
I don't read it as being restricted to only one side of the State Highway.
Yes, when I read your current statement, it looks like it could be both. So could you be clear for me?
It is both sides.
It is both, and you have considered them both. Yes. So on the north side, how would stormwater be dealt with?
The same way, through existing water courses that discharge from culverts under State Highway 6.
But on the north side, then?
It
doesn't go that way, does it?
It doesn't go that way, but it passes through the north side and north side. Right, it's the south side. So it passes from the south side to the north side of the highway through culverts. Both sides of the highway, there exist in water courses.
Okay. I'll have a look at these. Thank you. But you did consider it from both sides of the highway. Clear, thank you.
In terms of your natural hazard description here, you rely heavily on the 2008 process.
It's partly because I'm not a geotechnical engineer.
I was just saying, the whole geotechnical engineering profession's had an enormous shake-up quite literally since 2008, and whether there would be merit in having that report refreshed in the light of current thinking.
We had discussions with Geosolve. Geosolve is a company that's come out of Tonkin and Taylor. They hold the license, in fact, for previous reporting, filing and so on. The Geosolve is a Queenstown-based company. Had discussions about the effect of that activity area 8 being outside of the 2008 report. They recommended further investigation be carried out, and that's what I refer to in my evidence. They did not say that the whole report needed to be refreshed. So it wasn't in their mind at that time. I didn't ask that question though, so it's a possibility. But it was, it certainly wasn't something that they raised with me.
So you're happy that any lingering issues can easily be dealt with at consent stage? Either for subdivision or planning consent.
Correct. The report was comprehensive, and of course, ground conditions don't change in many years. additional science has been applied around liquefaction, for example, as a result of earthquakes in New Zealand. So I accept that there could be a different opinion now, but it wasn't raised by then. There's definitely one part of Actinoderia 8 that is outside of the original report, so that needs to be revisited.
Just if I can assist on that point as well, going back to my that might be my summary, that it's the matters of control and discretion all the related natural hazards to help inform the care for the assessment.
I'm not in there, yeah. Okay, thank you.
It might be easier just to start Mr. Hunt when we resume.
Very well, Cindy.
So I'll adjourn until 1:55.
Thank you, sir.